We're talking with Nick Redfern about time travel, the science and science fiction of time travel, his latest book. And you have to wonder if it's possible to travel through time, if future humans can figure out how to do it, then where are they? Why aren't we seeing them? Or are we seeing them? Could they be what we call UFOs, or we assume to be aliens from other planets, as opposed to humans coming back from the future to see when we screwed everything up? We're going to get into that and open up the phone lines, see what's on your mind. Maybe you've had a time slip experience yourself, or you had a question about time travel that you'd like to put to Nick Redfern. We'll be right back and get right to it. Nick Redfern, a friend of yours, the late Mac Taney's, had some ideas about time travel and how it might relate to aliens. Share with us what you wrote in the book.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mac had some interesting theories and concepts, and one of them that he had was the idea that that time travelers, possibly from the past and the future, might actually sort of present themselves as extraterrestrials, as sort of like a camouflage, if you like, which is a fascinating scenario. And it's one of those angles that really makes you think, you know, the idea that what if they aren't aliens? What if they're not extraterrestrials? What if they are really time travelers, but presenting themselves in a different way? And that, I think, is an intriguing arena, if you like, to look into. And I mean, there's another sort of similar situation to that. You know, when we're looking at this, and for example, the famous Rendlesham Forest case, UFO landing in December 1980. Sort of one of the most famous UFO cases. Well, one of the guys who was involved at the time, Jim Peniston, he said that the entities that he saw in Rendlesham Forest basically sort of mainlined into his mind, in his brain, if you like, all this data, including data suggesting that that the entities that came into in Rendlesham Forest were time travelers, and the future was in a very, very bad situation, and they come back to our presence to essentially, like with an alien abduction scenario, but taking DNA and things like this to try and beef up, if you like, the future. And so there's a lot of stories along those lines, like this, and similar to the one that Mac Taney's talked about, the idea of being a time traveler and the best way to sort of act in a stealthy fashion is to present yourself not with a UFO, excuse me, not with a time traveling machine, but with a UFO, that kind of thing, and make people to think, you know, it's extraterrestrials when it could really be us.
Yeah, the question of little green men, or little gray men, maybe more accurately, being us from the future suggests that we've really done something wrong. That would explain maybe why they came back to this time, a time in our history where we're making decisions that are really bad decisions, and we might have reached a point of no return, for the planet could change quite a bit in the decades ahead, and humans end up looking like these guys. Or, as you discuss in the book, they are, in essence, bio-robots that are engineered to travel back through time so that the humans of the future don't put themselves at risk. What do you think?
Well, that's an interesting angle, because one of the most sort of controversial people in the Roswell arena was Colonel Philip Corso. And in 1997, he wrote a book, The Day After Roswell. And one of the things that Corso said, a lot of people don't realize this, but Corso said that, yes, there was a crash and strange bodies were found. However, Corso said, as you just brought up, this is angle of biological robots. And according to what Corso said, at least, that the the creatures on board the wrecked craft that came down outside of Roswell, that basically they were not extraterrestrials, but they were biological robots, if you like, and they actually came to our world, if you like, through time rather than through space, and so that angle often gets overlooked by many people. You know, people just listen to Corso's story. Yeah, there were bodies, and there was a crash out there in the desert. But Corso said that no, that is not really the full story. The full story is that it was more of a time machine rather than a flying saucer, so to speak. And again, that would be a classic example of being able to hide themselves under an arena of stories of flying saucers and UFOs and aliens and extraterrestrials, when really it's an aspect of us coming back and looking at the 1940s and see what's going on, and they have a tragic and disastrous accident, and they come down at Roswell. And now, whether people buy into that or not, you know, it's a controversial scenario, and yet another one that places us in an alternative angle for time travel.
Well, I'd have to predict some whopping liability lawsuits in the future then if these time-traveling tourists came back and crashed at Roswell. Somebody's going to have to pay big for that. You also take it a step further and discuss the possibility of MIBs, these men in black, might be from the future.
Mm. Well, that's one that story of the men in black being time-travelers is one that I've got a lot of data on. You know, I've done several books on the Men in Black, and of course, you know, when you write a book, you know, people give you feedback, and over the years, I've got a lot of stories where people have seen the Men in Black and had encounters with them and been warned to stay away from this, stay away from that, in relation to like a UFO event. But what's particularly intriguing is that some of them were actually told by the people they threatened that, you know, we're from the future rather than extraterrestrials, and don't be meddling with this situation because it's going to alter the future, that kind of thing. But there are a lot of researchers in the MIB arena who do believe that the men in black are sort of almost like, although they are sort of perceived as, I guess, sort of, you know, a form of police, if you like, or security guards, that kind of thing. However, they're doing it, you know, under the guise of being just sort of regular people, but they're actually police, if you like, who are working to stop the future from being affected. And so the idea, you know, that concept of the MIB trying to make the right, you know, they're not actually the bad guys at all. You know, they're really just sort of finding ways to prevent the future from going downhill.
Well, there'd have to be rules about time travel, or what you can do when you come back, assuming you travel back in time, because, you know, you can really screw things up, I guess. There's a lot more to talk about, but let's take some calls here. A lot of folks on the line. We'll go to the first-time caller line first. John in Palm Harbor, Florida. Good morning, John.
Hello, George. I had a question for your guest. I've listened to your show a long time, and the first time I've called, and my question was, and a story that happened to me, is it possible that some of these people that disappear go into some kind of portal and we never see them again? And what happened to me, back in the late 1970s, a friend of mine and I, we went to a quarry outside of Toledo, Centennial Quarry, and it was late at night. We went back along this trail, and the trail goes straight down into the quarry. We passed a guy. I've been married 40 years, and I finally told my wife the story. His eyes were almost red, and he said, "Don't go back there." Well, we went back down this narrow trail that if you fell off it, you'd go straight into the quarry. We got back into this area, and the air started getting like a misty green, kind of white, like a fog, but there was no smell. When we looked into where we were going, there was like, I went over this over and over and over again in my mind. There was like a black sun coming off the water where the quarry was at. There was two individuals, one that looked like a smaller Grim Reaper and one tall individual with a barrel. We walked down to a certain point. There was a piece of metal on the ground, a round disc. I picked it up. I still have it to this day. My friend said that when I picked it up, it was like the TV, you know, how it would go on and off. He said, "John," he says, "your body kind of just went in and out, in and out, in and out." We went back to, we were getting out of there then. We were scared. That mist kind of followed us. It was like time didn't, I can't explain it. It was like a weightlessness, like time was just totally absent. We got to this trail, George. It was completely covered with barbed wire. And it was a good 300, 400 feet. There was no way anybody had any time to do that. And by the time we got back to our car, 2 hours had went by since we left. And it seemed like it was 5 minutes. But, you know, all this time, my wife asked me where I got this disc at. It's a piece of artwork is what it is. It's about 6 inches. It's like solid brass. And that's where I got it at. But my question is, were we close to possibly disappearing and never being seen again? Is that where all these people that disappeared could possibly go?
Well, I mean, in theory, I guess it's possible. I mean, the one part of the story that you just mentioned that fascinated me was this angle of like a fog or a mist kind of aspect to it. There are a lot of stories in time travel where people have said they've seen very often like a green fog and sometimes in sort of a gray or a white fog. But there are a number of cases where people have sort of gone through time briefly and yet they've sort of been able to go experience it by going through this strange green fog. So that there may be a tie in there. You know, that's a possibility. And again, this demonstrates the sort of random nature of these events rather than having technology which, you know, we can just specifically go to this time frame or to that one. It's another example of how it very much is random.
I'd really be interested in getting that disc, that 6-inch disc, analyzed, yeah. See what it's made of, too. Have you ever thought about doing that, John?
You know, I ended up getting into metalwork, and I have not been able to figure this out. And I can send you a picture of it if you like. At first, I thought maybe we walked into an occult type thing going on back there. I just didn't know because the person that we met had a strange hat and his eyes were red. And the disc was right at the beginning of the trail, and I picked it up. And my friend, he said it was like your TV blinks on and off. He said, "John," he said, you appeared, reappeared, appeared, I said, "You're crazy, you know." But since that time, this thing is, it's just different. I can send you a picture of it. I thought about having it analyzed. I just never have gotten around to it. It's really different. It's just, I've never seen anything like it.
Well, if you get it analyzed, send us an email. In fact, send me an email anyway. I'd like to maintain communication with you and talk a little bit further about it. But thanks for the call. That was really interesting.
Okay, thank you now. Bye-bye.
So I want to ask you, Nick, before we get about 3 minutes before we go to a break, about the grandfather paradox, because that's what people always bring up. Well, if you go back in time and change something, if you kill your grandfather, you couldn't be here to go back in time to begin with. What is your feeling about that? If we were to travel back in time, you're not necessarily in the same reality. You could be traveling to a different reality, and thus you could in effect change that reality without killing yourself.
Yeah, and actually, you sort of hit the nail there, George, when you brought that particular scenario. Then people, you know, sort of say time travel's not possible because if you did go back and you killed your grandfather, you wouldn't be born. So how could you go back and right. And go through the whole process? And the primary theory that most time travel researchers how they explain this would be sort of multiple timelines, but also multi-realities as well. In other words, there could be a time, you know, another world, another Earth, and possibly even versions of us. You know, possibly the idea, you know, there could be multiple timelines all at the time developing, and in one sense at least, that would allow for a situation where you wouldn't be killed. You would just, whether directly or inadvertently, you would yourself would create a new timeline. And some researchers have suggested there could be literally thousands or millions of timelines where you really have sort of multiple versions of us, which is, sounds really weird, you know, and so kind of like a little bit creepy even as well. But that's basically the primary theory to get around the grandfather phenomenon is the idea of multiple timelines and multiple realities.
The multiverse, I mean, there's a lot of cutting edge physicists who accept that as real, that that it is what explains quantum mechanics, quantum physics, better than any other version of reality they can explain, that every decision you make in your life, you turn left instead of turning right, splits off into some other version of you, other versions of reality, which is mind-boggling to think about. We're talking with Nick Redfern about time travel, the science and science fiction, his latest book. It goes into a lot of really interesting scenarios, including sort of viewing remote viewing as a way to peer back into the future. Nick has a chapter about remote viewing and some of the best practitioners of that who were able to look back in time at Mars, at an ancient civilization that lived there and was in big trouble. We'll get to that if we can and take as many of your calls as we can when we come back here for our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Nick Redfern. We have one segment remaining to talk about his newest book, Time Travel, the Science and Science Fiction. Fascinating stuff. I've got a lot of people on the phones, but if you want to try to get in, still got a couple of open lines, and we'll be right back with our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. We go back to the phones, starting with east of the Rockies, Joe, Long Island, New York, back there in Montauk territory. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
Yeah, the mysteries. Hey, Nick, if the people that claim to have met people that came presently, that, you know, people that traveled from the future, do these people claim that they are visiting us now from the future, that they were able to target this particular time, that they were able to target particular people? And how difficult was it for them to travel from the future into the present? And for the people that go back in time, this is just speculation, would it be harder to go back in time as it goes further back in time?
Yeah, I wonder, like the Terminator, how'd he find Sarah Connor, Nick?
Well, I mean, in terms of, you know, how they could do that and so on, again, it sort of comes to, for the most part, random events. You know, we're not talking at all. And that is one of the reasons I wanted to sort of write the book, to demonstrate to people the what seems to be the reality of genuine time travel is that all of these events are random, you know. At least, apart from the stories, like, for example, from Jim Peniston, where clearly, you know, if the story is correct, then, you know, we're talking about sort of specific events and specific times and specific places, but most people don't report that. Most people report that it just happened out of the blue, and they had no understanding of how it happened, only that they saw something that was clearly in the past, and they were briefly able to see whatever it was, and then everything suddenly became back to normal again.
Thanks for the call, Joe. We're going to Bill in Los Angeles on Wildcard One. Hi, Bill. What's on your mind?
How you doing, George?
All right.
George, and hi, Nick. George, do you remember that Star Trek episode where, I'm sure you do, where Kirk and Spock return to Prohibition-era America as gangsters?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the best. And it had a really poignant ending, too, that speaks to the grandfather paradox. You probably remember that Kirk has to let his newfound girlfriend die in a car accident because it might change the future for America. And it's one of the few, you know, kind of sad ending Star Treks. And he says, Spock, let's get the hell out of here.
Well, that time travel, you got to make some tough calls on that stuff. Yeah, I sort of remember it. I didn't remember the ending, but thanks for sharing that.
But yeah, I mean, there are, you know, cases like that where, you know, it could be sort of bad for us if, you know, we change something, whether deliberately or inadvertently, whichever way you look at it, there is a possibility that if one day we are able to achieve full-on time travel, it could actually result in hazards, you know, major hazards even.
Thanks for the call. We got another Bill in Los Angeles on a wild card line. To Bill number two, what's on your mind? How you doing? Hello? I think we lost that Bill. How about we try Keith in Clear Lake, Iowa? Hello, Keith.
I guess I look at time travel as more of not a physical.
Hello? I think we just lost Keith here. All right, let's go to first-time caller Lucy in Kansas. Hi, Lucy. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hi, good morning. I had a question. I was going through the Art Bell Vault for, like, past 3 days, coincidentally, or there are no coincidences. And he had a guest called David Anderson of Anderson Institute, and he was talking about how India was in the lead of time travel technologies. He didn't want to call it time travel. He wanted to call it time control technologies. And to get to one of your previous callers who asked about is it worse to go forward or backward, he actually brought up that it made no difference. But that to look at time, not in hours or seconds, but to look at it in meters. So whatever happened to that technology, I mean.
You mean the technology to do that, you mean, to time travel?
The time control technology, if it was already developed and India was in the lead, mm-hmm. Where is it now?
Well, I guess the answer would be we don't know for sure that it was developed. That was one guest on the program a long time ago. Nick, unless you have some insight into that.
Well, I wasn't too sure what the question was, really.
I think she's saying that there was a guest on the show, Anderson, who said that India had developed some kind of time control technology, and she's asking, where is it now?
Oh, I see. No, unfortunately, I don't know about that one at all, no.
Sorry, Lucy. Appreciate you calling, though. We're going to go to Dale, west of the Rockies. Are you there, Dale? Oh, we already had Dale in Long Beach. Okay, yeah, we do have Dale. Hey, Dale, how you doing?
Yeah, I've seen the mysterious jetpack guy. It's not a jetpack guy. It was like a big silver ball that came across the sky on a August afternoon with no wind whatsoever. Me and my friend both seen it. He watched it wear a pair of binoculars. When it came across the sky, it was cloaked out in infrared. I'm just speculating because all you could see was like a big shiny light. The light, like when you're going to Vegas on the 15 where they have those two towers where all the panels are pointed at them and they're so bright white you can hardly look at them. It was bright white like that, kind of shiny white. came across the sky, did the weirdest thing you've ever seen, went round and round like a bird and climbed way up in the sky, was throwing out some kind of hologram that made it look like it had feathers. When it got way high, it was hanging in the sky. We watched it with a pair of binoculars. It was facing the sun. It was facing the sun for about maybe 10 minutes or less, and then it went straight up to where I couldn't see it with my eyes anymore. My friend was watching it with the binoculars, and he couldn't see it anymore. It made no noise, no sound whatsoever. And then, so it's the weirdest, strangest thing we ever seen.
You think that is what's being mistaken for the jetpack guy?
Right, because there's three incidents with the jetpack guy. The first pilot says he's seen a jetpack. The second pilot was the co-pilot of the Korean plane, and he said when the lady asked him if it was a jetpack or AUV, and he said something like that, too shiny and too fast. The third incident, the jet pilot picked him up in Anaheim, 20 miles east of LAX, and he said that he seen it again before he landed. When he landed, that was 175 knots, 20 miles west of where he first seen it. That's not a balloon.
Yeah, I think you're right. Dale, I wasn't quite sure I bought the jetpack explanation anyway, but thanks for sharing that story with us. Nick, are you following that story at all?
No, I haven't really followed it to any extent, really, no.
We're going to the wild card line, Michael in Michigan. Hi, Michael. You're on with Nick Redfern.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, George. I want to ask Nick, what is his credibility he thinks about Project Pegasus with Andrew Basaglia, if he ever did any research in reference to that?
Sorry,
Andrew Basaglia. I think he's talking about Project Pegasus. Isn't that about traveling to Mars, something like that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the whole angle of Mars is a fascinating one. The idea, you know, of going from A to Z, so to speak. But then you've also got the angle of the so-called secret space program that suggests that might already people on Mars. And, you know, the whole thing is fascinating. I mean, before the break, when George brought up Mars in relation to remote viewing, that's one of the things that I talk about. And thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, we know that on May 22nd, 1984, the CIA ran an experiment to remote view the planet Mars. And they did so not as how to see how Mars looks now, but how it looked hundreds of thousands of years ago, into the way into the distant time, if you like. And the remote viewers were able to see what was, in essence, if you like, the last vestiges of Mars and the Martian civilization. Now, we don't know why the CIA decided to remote view Mars in 1984, but what we know is that they did it. And it talks about Mars just sort of becoming like a dead world and its civilization as well. And this demonstrates a different kind of time travel, but it's still time travel. The idea of using your mind by remote viewing and propelling your mind, if you like, into the distant past. And again, an alternative version, if you like, of time travel.
Was that Ingo Swann who looked at Mars and saw those people, or was it one of the other ones?
No, it wasn't actually him, but it was basically all of the guys, you know, who have been on the remote viewing program knew about this. And over the years, several remote viewers now have been asked to look into Mars in terms of to try and find out, you know, are there ancient structures on Mars, pyramids, that kind of thing.
Do you know if those in the FOIA documents about the remote viewing program, is there any looking into the future, or can they only look back?
Well, primarily it's into the past, yes. There are some cases, as far as Mars is concerned, everything is in the distant past. But what fascinates me, George, is the fact as specifically why was the CIA so intrigued about investigating Mars, and not just in the present, but a long, long time ago, hundreds of thousands of years ago. Clearly something caught their attention. But even to this today, the experiment, the first one was 1984, and we still don't know the reason why the CIA had that deep interest in trying to find out what happened to Mars.
Yeah, it's not like they just pulled that out of their hat.
Yeah.
There's some other piece of information there.
Yeah.
East of the Rockies, David in Essex, Maryland. Hi, David. Welcome to Coast to Coast. What's on your mind?
I'd like to talk to Nick about the work of the mathematician Ferdinand Möbius and his concept of time travel involving the Möbius strip, especially in conjunction with his fellow British author, Brian Lumley, who wrote a series of books in which the hero travels to Möbius's grave and through mathematics and the Möbius strip enters a thing called the Möbius continuum.
Nick, does that ring a bell?
A little bit.
Huh? He's asking you if you know the thing about the mathematician Möbius or the Möbius continuum.
Oh, no, I don't. No.
Did you want to tell us a little bit more about it, David? Or?
Yeah. In the series of books called Necroscope by Brian Lumley, who's also a British author, he travels to the grave of the mathematician Ferdinand Möbius, who was a great mathematician, who came up with the concept of the Möbius strip. And using the Möbius strip, he travels into this thing called the Möbius continuum, in which he can travel not only through time, but through space also.
Huh. That's really interesting. You know, there's a story that we wrote, came out a couple of weeks ago, about a Möbius strip appearing inside of a building at Skinwalker Ranch. And it is what was seen by a DIA analyst that sort of led to the creation of the OSAP program, looking into UFOs and related phenomena. I'm going to look for that information about this Möbius continuum and share it with Dr. Jim Lukacsky. I think he'd be interested in hearing it. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
The gentleman's name is Brian Lumley. You can go to his website. He has a series of books called the Necroscope series.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the tip there. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll try to get one more call in here. Joe in Monterey, California, on the Wild Card Line. Good morning.
Thank you, George. Oh, great music tonight, George.
Thank you.
This is a concept, and I have some experiences to back it up. But if we are to believe that we are interdimensional, that maybe we affect time and space on an individual level, and that we can control or affect time that we experience as an individual, also that people do go back in time spiritually and can affect the past. But from what I'm told, the present, or shall I say, everything is happening simultaneously. And that's a mind-boggler.
Well, yeah, I mean, everything about time travel is sort of mind-boggling, you know. It's, I guess the angle of it, you know, trying to get your mind around how can we sort of know things that haven't happened yet, and yet that's what actually happens in some cases. A classic example would be John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies. I'm sure everybody's heard of Mothman, so I won't go too deep into that, but in the 1966-67, there was this strange creature called Mothman that was seen at Point Pleasant, West Virginia, flying around in the skies, this creature with these red eyes. And Keel himself and a number of other people who lived in the city of Point Pleasant had prophetic dreams of a disaster, a looming disaster, just literally weeks away. And certainly that's exactly what happened in December 1967, the Silver Bridge, as it was called, that covered the Ohio River, fell into the river, killing dozens of people who lived at Point Pleasant. And as I said, Keel had these prophetic dreams leading up to what actually really did happen, a massive disaster in the city. And it's very difficult to put our mind around how people like Keel were able to do that. Mm. And yet, from our perspective, it hadn't happened at all. And again, so we've got a form of time travel, but a very kind of alternative time travel when you've got prophetic dreams of the future.
Joe, thanks for the call. Nick Redfern, Time Travel, the Science and Science Fiction. That's a lot of fun to read. I appreciate you being here. You've done another great job.
Thanks, George. See you later.
Thank you. Thanks also to Jacques Vallée, his book about Trinity, The Best Kept Secret, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Donna Walker and Michael Cosio, Adam Thompson, our webmaster Lex Lonehood, Dan Galani, and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday night. Hope you can tune in then. Good night, everyone.